two. I want you to understand the implications of the last thing that we studied Thursday night. We said the thought is silent speech. So when you think, you say. Except you say at a rate of 1,300 words a minute. So you get a lot said. Normal speech is about 110 or 15. And think of what it said, think of the implications. Whatsoever you say shall be done for you by my Father which is in heaven. Think about that with regard to what you think.
Got your head scary.
And what you say about other people.
What you think.
Scary.
Jesus said in another way, he said, if you think it, you've done it. The reason is whatever you think about a person is how you respond to that person. And the person has no knowledge that you're
murdering them.
Or whatever you're doing.
Unless they're really spiritual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they got a go meter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whatsoever you say, if your thought is silent speech, you're thinking at the rate of 1,300 words a minute, whatsoever you say shall be done for you by my Father which is in heaven. There's some serious implications here. Amen?
Amen.
Okay, somebody read Luke 2, verse 40.
And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him.
And now Luke 2:52.
And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature, and in favor with God and man.
Okay. Those are the only scriptures that are written essentially about Christ, except the one, you know, the preceding that was that he hung around in Jerusalem at Passover. From the time that he was born until he was 30 years old. Why? If you were writing the Bible, if you were writing the New Testament, wouldn't you have written a whole bunch about what Jesus' early childhood or early manhood was like?
Sure. Figure the right way to raise a kid.
Why are they the silent years, really from birth to 30? Why isn't there anything written about him? And what was going on in him? And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit and filled with wisdom. And the grace of God was upon him. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. What was going on in his mind?
He didn't know.
How did he respond? You're right. He didn't know he was Messiah until it was witnessed by the Holy Spirit at his baptism. Just like you don't know who you are, he didn't know who he was. Does that make sense? Do you believe that? Do you really believe that?
It seems strange that he didn't talk about his childhood or something to the disciples.
He probably did.
But they didn't think.
But the wisdom, well, they thought it was very important. But they also knew he probably, I'm sure he told them, look, you can't talk about this. This is stuff that's between you and me. Because if you talk about this, then people will make an idol of it.
So these scriptures really say that this, it was a dawning awareness, and he wasn't just this super guy all the time, super wise.
When he was born and he was dumping in his pants and crying, did he know he was God?
But what about when he reached the age of 13 and came accountable under the law? Was there... No,
well, that's a recent.
Because they used that him talking to the temple, to those in the temple, teaching them.
Yeah, that's from the age of 13, from the age of 12 on, he was in a different state than he was from birth to 12. What was that different state? But let's first talk about from 0 to 12.
He would have been covered through his parents.
He could speak in the synagogue.
Do you understand that from birth to 12 years of age, there's no sin? From birth to 12, it's impossible for you to sin. From 12, when you become familiar with the law, then you're held accountable. So from 12 on was the only time that we're concerned with the idea that Christ was without sin. What was he doing between? What was he doing in his mind from 0 to 12 and from 12 to 30? Think about it. I spent years trying to think about it.
Wanting to listen?
What I want you to understand is he wasn't any different than you are.
So he would have been just like any other kid?
He'd have probably been a little more precocious. It says he was quick. The prophecies about him are the only place we can go. It says he was quick in understanding and the fear of the Lord. But, you know, your mind wants to take it. Well, he must have been a super kid.
Based on experience and based on what we study and based on what I remember reading, it seems like he probably had an intensive course in rejecting stuff, an intensive course in seeing through stuff, an intensive course in trying this and seeing it was vain, trying that and seeing it was vain, discarding stuff.
Quickly.
And he probably was a real pain in the ass. He was probably a massive pain in the ass.
The God that created the universe, universe was created of and by him and for him, and for him all things exist, by him all things exist. And yet here he was, this little baby. The only way that we can possibly understand the incarnation is to understand the risk that God took in this action. That God would tabernacle in flesh. That he would go through the childhood diseases. That he would, you know, have a temperature of 105. That he would be at risk always. I mean, it's...
And why wasn't he afraid of dying? I mean, you know, appendicitis. I mean, they didn't have any... Why wasn't God afraid that he would die at birth or of an infection? An accident?
He couldn't have, though, could he? Because it would have been fulfilled.
Well... there's a million questions that we could ask that we can't know. But all I want you to do is to contemplate this whole arena of Jesus learning a language, because that's what we're studying, names, of Jesus learning to name things, and of the struggles that he went through. It had to be wild. For God to be this little, for a long time he couldn't speak, couldn't control his body.
Wouldn't he have had angels ministering to him too, I mean, throughout his life, you know?
Sure, but angels can't. Angels have boundaries.
But his mind is programmed by his parents and his surroundings and his society just like ours.
Right.
I mean, that thing had to be filled up with something. It was filled with Joseph and Mary and
Moloch.
Elizabeth.
He had to learn to reject and see through the Moloch.
I don't know if I can say this right, but if God put himself into the child, who was left in control?
Well, God is, if you can imagine, remember that thing that we've done, that God... God the Father is God in eternity. God the Holy Spirit is God in space without regard to time. And God the Son is God in time and space. I don't know that I can understand it. I don't know if I could. I don't know that I could communicate how that can happen. That when God the Father didn't change in eternity, but he became God the Son in time and space. He took on the tabernacle of flesh in this environment so that we would be in exactly the same position that Christ was in. Because now we have the same holy seed within us that Christ did. The difference is that we are now, if we abandon ourselves, we are assured of the outcome. We can bet the farm. I'm not too sure Jesus could. Because if you can conceive of it, the genetic structure of that was a new thing that transpired.
Would this be true that the Father knew it, but the Son didn't?
Mm-hmm. No man knoweth the hour or the time, etc., etc. But
I mean, he may well have thought that he failed.
I'm sure he probably did 1,000 times. But all I want you to do in this arena is, if you can understand it, it can comfort you if you're ever in confusion. Because you know that the course is set, the path is sure. And that's why he can be confident, why he could leave and know that the plan would be accomplished. Because the DNA of the Spirit, if you will, was set firmly in place. He had completed the way. But I don't want to spend that wasn't even what we're supposed to talk about. We're talking about names. But I wanted you to understand that he had to go through the same process. Okay?
Of naming things.
Naming and then unnaming. Naming and seeing the vanity of naming. All right.
Yeah, we really are in the same exact situation. Because God said a long, long time ago, the serpent will bruise your heel, and the seed of the woman will bruise his head, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's what he had.
Right.
And that's what we've got.
Except we've got a more sure word of prophecy.
Well.
Because he completed the way. So the way is set. He was the pioneer.
Yeah, but it's still words.
Mm-hmm. So that before Christ came, there was a hope of a Messiah, but
now Jesus Christ, Messiah, is come in the flesh. He still has to go through the same struggle of names.
So the promises to Moses.
To Abraham.
To Abraham, you know, versus the promise, what we see.
The promise of Abraham is not to seeds as of many, but to the one seed, which is Christ. Christ is your life. Okay? What?
Well, I don't want to belabor, but I mean, what Christ had was he had words. And that they were either true or not true, and he could either believe them or not believe them, but there were words. It was prophecy. It was history. And you just said that he didn't know it until the Spirit descended on him and he saw it and he heard it and he experienced it. And I guess what I'm saying is that's the situation I find myself in. I've got words.
I know, but the difference is there wasn't anyone that had gone that way before. When he walked the walk.
Yeah.
Am I studying?
Yeah, I'm not saying it's the same thing. All I'm saying is from my ridiculous standpoint, it's the same thing.
Okay.
Because I don't know that. I guess it is.
So by his studying the law, when he came into the cage of accountability, he started to unname things, started to see that you can't fulfill the law as
flesh.
As the flesh.
He started to see who he was, though. Yeah. That was the dawning awareness of who he was. Each time he studied the scriptures, each time he celebrated a feast, there was a clearer and clearer revelation to him, to his mind, who he was, and how because of who he was, he could unname. He could truly live in the dependence. Mm-hmm. He could you could truly say, I do nothing of or from myself. Whatsoever I see the Father do, that is what I do. And that can only be revealed in abandonment. He showed us the perfect way how to abandon to the Father.
Because he had to see that he was the seed that was spoken to Abraham, so that even it was before then and before then.
Right.
And he has, why would he get even see that?
Well, he can see it the same way we see it.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, just him being the first person to have that revelation that he was.
He not only had words, though, we got to hear this, and this is what he finally saw when he was baptized. He not only had words, he was the Word. And that's... That'll hurt your brain.
So even in that time, you said it was a real... There was a messianic period where everyone was awaiting Messiah, so I don't know if everyone was talking about it, but there was a level of expectancy that hadn't ever existed before.
Right. Yeah, so it wasn't just words. He had the words, but he also had... The time is now and the place is here.
He had the Logos. He had the appointed time.
Yeah.
Or if he had the information from his parents, these Magi guys that came and said, I mean, they'd like say, that's him? That's his parents?
Well, he probably did, but his parents forgot it.
Angels said it.
Angels said it, but they forgot it.
Shepherds said it.
There's a category of names in each language that are really interesting. And I'm not too sure how they apply, but there's a word, the word that describes this phenomenon in English is a weird word. It's onomatopoeia. Hmm. And it means that the word sounds like the thing that it is. Is that right?
I'm not sure. I know the terminology, but that sounds right.
It sounds like what it means.
For example, crash.
Kerplunk.
Or maim.
Pow.
Or luscious.
Ooze.
Delicious.
Or ooze.
That's a good voice.
Or sensuous.
Okay.
Perfect.
Gotcha.
Erect.
I know you're like a woolly
forest.
And gorge.
Take your punishment like a man.
Moist.
Okay. Bam.
Okay. Where do you see that coming a long way off?
All right.
On a one-way.
The idea of those words is can you, I mean, it always amazes me when I stop and think about language, about when these words were developed.
Oyster.
The big one is how did people first decide to eat something? I mean, eat a snail. So anyway, the idea of making a name I wish we could do this in Hebrew. I don't know, I'm not saying I'm a Hebrew expert, but I know enough Hebrew to know it's grand simplicity. It's the most efficient language to describe spirit. I mean, there's no other language that even compares to it. But the idea that a name was itself is impossible. I mean, we may play those games like, you know, sensuous sounds like, but it really doesn't. But the only one that is the same as it is the Word or the Logos. And that's a hard concept to think about. That'll hurt your brain to understand that the Word is the Word. But for most words, what they do is they define. To define is to classify and to differentiate. This is like this, but different than that. And that's what all words do. And in science, we have the genus, the family, the species, so that we can say it's like this, but it's different than that. And in that idea of words, it causes us to slowly but surely be able to specify that we can communicate without pointing. That's really the core of language. A name and its definition are substitutes for one another. And there are different types of definitions. Essentially, there are five different types. There's physical, genetic, analytic, descriptive, and teleological. There's five different kinds of definitions. The first one is physical. And the physical kind of names name the parts and the relationship to one another. The second is genetic, and it states the process of production. The third is analytic, and names the component parts of the materials. The fourth is descriptive, and it names a sufficient number of features to make the object recognizable. And the fifth is what's called teleological. It names the purpose or the use or the function of the thing. Now, if you understand teleological is the study of purpose in nature, and therefore it is really theological. What we like to think about, what is this? What purpose does this have? What's the function of this? Why are we alive? What's the purpose of the universe? Why am I here? These are the first questions that you ever ask yourself. And you have to understand that no matter if you call yourself an atheist, the act of asking that question is theology. The only difference is you've made yourself the God. One directs the attention of people through language by saying that an object is either includes or excludes this particular name from other names. And as your mind goes through the process, then your mind says, if I say the word cat, you don't think of, okay, well, that's like a lion, but not like a rock, and it's in many ways like a pig, but it's not like a tree. Your mind automatically goes through all these options, and that process of going through those options, saying it's like this but unlike this, is what you've spent a lifetime studying. Just remember as a small child and saying the word cat. It had to have, the mind had to say it's like that but unlike that. And so now if I say cat, you have an instant image of what that is. But it's not that instant. Your mind goes through all of these options until it finally narrows it down and it says, oh, that's what you mean. You got it? Now, if you're blindfolded and put in a room, you know, and it's the old... Or better yet, if you there's a hole in the wall and you put your hand through the, and you've never seen this being that's on the other side, and you touch a part of it, and you are asked to describe it, your description would be extremely limited. If I blindfolded you and asked you to describe, if I said a word and asked you to describe it, or better yet, if you're blindfolded and you're given something and asked to describe it. I mean, you go through this huge, huge thing of what it is like and what it isn't. And that's what, when you play these games, like, what's the game where you say, sounds like, or?
Charades.
That's what you do in charades. That's why charades has any appeal, because that's what you do normally. But charades slows the process down. Now, sentences, we got a bunch of individual names, and sentences are therefore maps of names that each one of us create. And they're created for another in order that they may reach the goal of our desired thought. I'm sitting here tonight describing words to you in sentences, so that somehow or another I'm able to communicate to you the image that I have in my mind, or the lack of an image. And so that's the only reason of sentences. Now, it's axiomatic, it's a given, it's automatic that the purpose of a sentence, and this is, I want you to think about this long and hard, the purpose of a sentence is to manipulate someone else.
Now, I'm teaching the kids, and today I was reviewing what I'm going to do semester with in the book, And I hadn't thought about writing like this because after a while you just kind of do it. But at that level, when you're learning writing, it talks about descriptive paragraphs or narrative where you just explain. It talks about inductive and deductive. And just when you're informing somebody how to use these tools of words and manipulate, argumentative, it talks about argumentative debate-oriented papers. It's like, gosh, this is the basis for what they will do with words.
The basis of language is to manipulate. Now, the greatest way to witness this is to watch what happens when somebody is interested in you or you are interested in somebody, male-female type. You will see more tricks of language of trying to either, you know, of the parry, the thrust and, no, I can't say that, the thrust and parry of language, of the debate that goes on in and it's pure manipulative. I mean, there's no question. I mean, the person that's doing it will agree that it's manipulative because it's so obvious. But every sentence you speak is manipulative. If there was no need in you for manipulation, there would be no need for sentences. Everybody understand that?
Reminds me as a kid, you know, I used to get so mad at my sister because she was so much better at
manipulating
words than what I was. I mean, like if you were fighting, she could just come back at you and you'd just be like, you couldn't say anything. I used to go, why can't I be like that? Or why can't I, you know, have that stab you back?
Mm. Yeah, well, what happens is if you lose a debate or if you lose a fight, what you do then is you go into your aloneness and you recreate the scenario, and it always has this, if I've only done this, if I'd only said that, and then you always win in your mind.
And the thought how pervasive it is, I mean, movies, you know, somebody sat down and wrote words in a certain order, and comedians, you know, these, you know, one man monologue deals where you're trying to elicit some response.
Yeah. By the use of names strung together, one states that the object of your thought is like this and unlike that until through awareness of the right names and its association, the other person thinks of the same thing of which the speaker is thinking. You confess to each other. And when you are able to, that homologio, which are speak the same thing to another person, then you feel like you've communicated. Because they have the same image in their mind that you have in yours. And so there's communication. You've touched something. Now, that's why it's so important that the only way we can get to the point of confessing the same thing with God is that we have to lose confessing the same thing with man. We have to lose the idea of manipulating with language. And especially you have to lose the idea of manipulating with prayer. Most prayers are simply acts of attempts to manipulate God. You see that? And so, by your attempt to manipulate God, by definition, you're placing yourself above God. Which is not too bright. Remember the morning Bible study when we talked about how you call God a liar and how that wasn't too bright? Well, this is another one that's not too bright, of putting yourself above God. Now, naming the same thing differently identifies it. And this is where we're getting into sentence structure. The subject and the predicate of a sentence name the same thing differently. If they name the same thing the same, it wouldn't be a sentence.
Subject and verbs.
Subject and predicate name the same thing differently.
Unless it's a form of B.
Huh?
Unless it's a form of B.
Yeah. Okay. Unless they name the same, unless the name is the same, there's no unity. Unless they name it differently, there's no thought. Okay, I said the subject and the predicate of a sentence, in order to be complete, the subject, it has to have the same subject, so it has to be that sameness, but unless they name it differently, there's no thought.
Do you have an example?
Well, every sentence is an example. That's a perfect example. My cat is gray. Cat and gray are different, but they are the same.
Oh.
My cat is a dog is impossible.
You mean flip it, my cat is gray, gray is my cat.
Right.
My cat thinks it's a dog.
All right.
That's
because of who the mistress of the cat is. Okay, names are like relations, are divided into three different realms. There's independent names, such as orange or apple or tree, and those are physical. Those are physical, or the body, right? I mean, that's physical names. There are psychological names. Those are mental names. Psychological names are what? Love, hate, pain, suffering. Those are psychological conditions. But there are associational names, and those are spiritual. In that sense, love can be both spiritual and mental. So those are the three realms of names are the same as the three realms that we live in, body, soul, and spirit. A name is a sound, and a sound is a vibration. Those three are exactly the same thing. A name is a sound. A sound is a vibration, or you wouldn't hear it. Am I communicating at all?
Yes.
All right. The spiritual, the mental, and the physical are all the same. They're identical. They are not similar, but the same identical thing, but they're related differently. But our language causes the illusion of the separation. The idea that the physical, the spiritual, and the mental are all the same thing. But it's our language that has divided it to cause us to think that there's these different dimensions. Does that communicate at all? If we were totally in union with God, we wouldn't see the three different. We wouldn't see anything as different. We'd see all as spiritual. Now, back to language. One thing is never another thing. But the same thing is given various names as a means to identify it. Now, and this is the only reason that sentences were created, or the stringing together of names. Now think about this one. This one sounds so simple, but it's really true. The meaning of the subject of a sentence may be unknown to the hearer, but not to the speaker. The meaning of the predicate of the sentence must be known to both. Understand that? The meaning of the subject of the sentence may be unknown to the hearer, but not to the speaker. The meaning of the predicate must be known to both, or it won't communicate.
Okay, go ahead, Barbara.
What is a predicate? What is a predicate? Subject?
No, the subject of the sentence is one thing. The predicate of a sentence is another thing.
Object.
The verb, the action. Like Bill walked to be the predicate. Is the action part of the sentence. not the doer. Is there?
Well, let the apple is red. Is the verb. The apple is the subject, and red is the predicate. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the verb and the thing after the verb is the predicate, the whole thing.
Okay, well, is just the instrument of describing the tense, or the instrument of describing. So the apple, okay, it's in order for me to use that as a sentence, that the apple is red, that's a complete sentence. It's necessary for me to know what the meaning of an apple is.
Right.
It's not necessary for you. Uh-huh. But it's vital that you know what red is. Otherwise, it isn't. It won't communicate. Okay, if I say to you, klub is vija. The only thing you understand is. Klub sounds like it could be an English name, but Vija sounds like it's nothing. But if I said Klub is Vija to my mother or to a Norwegian, then I would be speaking English and they would understand the sentence. If I say to you, Greece, have any of you been to Greece? None of you have been to Greece, okay? If I say to you, but you all have an image of Greece. Mm-hmm. But if I say to you, Greece is cold, first of all, you wouldn't believe it, because your image of Greece is the sunny Mediterranean, but it would help you to, it wouldn't be a good description. But if I said to you, Greece is mountainous, then you could understand that maybe because of the mountainous region, that it could be cold. Greece is cold and mountainous, or mountainous and cold in the wintertime, describes it further. Greece, the thing that's unknown to you is the condition of Greece, except by some travel log that you read. But mountainous, cold, are words that you have to understand. So the reason this is difficult to understand is because it's so basic. I mean, a sentence has to have the subject. All sentences have a subject and a predicate. And there wouldn't be a sentence without those two, subject, verb, and predicate. All sentences, the subject must be known to the speaker, but not necessarily to the hearer. But all sentences, the predicate must be known to both, or it won't be a sentence. Now, I want you to try to get down to the core level of names here. We're just talking about naming things and names, and then stringing together names to make a sentence. Do you understand that?
It would be like if you said somebody you knew from childhood that I had no idea who it was. As long as I understood what the predicate was, I'd be with you.
There would be some way that you could,
like, sort of
Rumpel.
Yeah, I have no idea.
You have no idea what Rumpel is.
Okay.
But if I said to you, Rumpel is my friend, then that would have, because you have some idea from my lifestyle of who a friend of mine would be. So there would be some communication. I mean, all I want you to do is to forget the rules of language for a minute and understand that to go beyond it, to go to the basics of what language is. It's a stringing together of names in a certain order. I didn't understand what that meant. I is the subject of the sentence. You. What the subject of the sentence, that context means that you see everything as how it affects you. And that's what I mean. It's a play on words, that everything, you make everything the subject of your sentence. All right. Through association of the known meaning of the predicate, it gives meaning to the subject. If I say to you, back to Rumpel, we'll pick on Rumpel. Rumpel is my friend. Rumpel is a bastard. which you probably expect someone to be blessed to be my friend. Rumpel is was my school. I went to school with Rumpel. But I could give you a whole series of predicates to the subject of Rumpel that would slowly but surely describe to you who Rumpel was until finally you would have an image in your mind of who he was without meeting him. And that's what the real purpose of a sentence is. The reason that we've gone through all of this is so we can get to one thing. And that's the one thing is the meaning and purpose of... Anybody complete the sentence?
Manipulation?
No.
Language?
No. The reason that names exist, the reason that sentences exist, the reason that I've studied all this stuff, the reason we've talked about all this, is so we could get to one point.
Repentance.
That's the fruit of what the one point is. It's the meaning and purpose of suffering. It's the only purpose of language. It's so that you can empathize and understand the meaning and purpose of suffering. Does that surprise you?
Well, it seems very narrow.
It's the only purpose of language. It's the only reason God permitted names to be named.
How can you say that?
Because I know.
But on the other hand, it's so that we would understand the meaning of happiness.
No. It has nothing to do with it. Every name that you can name only inhibits happiness. Every word that you can describe only lessens joy.
Because
language acts as a constrictor. The only purpose of language is so that we would be able to communicate the meaning of suffering.
Because by naming it, you automatically cause its bondage and limit it.
And I want you to put in bondage and so that you can understand and take dominion over suffering. The only universal thing that happens to all men, other than death, is what? Mental condition, is suffering.
But you're going to remember the suffering more than you're going to remember some happy moment or something.
Let's look at some scriptures. Just okay, this one I want Miss Sherry to read both of these. Romans 8, 17, verse 17.
I can find it.
Oh, that's good. She can't find Romans. How long have you been in Bible study?
8:17.
Could you do me a good favor?
Page away. And if children, they're heirs, then heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may also glorify it together.
Glorify it?
No. We also glorify together.
Okay.
Tell us what.
Okay, now go to 2 Timothy, chapter 2, verse 12.
If we suffer, we shall also reign with him.
Okay, that's enough. If we suffer with him, we shall reign with him. Romans 8 said,
if we suffer, we'll be glorified.
If we suffer, we'll be glorified. If we suffer, we'll reign. If we suffer, we'll be glorified. The only purpose of time and space is to reign and to be glorified with Christ. The only purpose of time and space is suffering. You hate to hear that. Now, compassion, well, Jesus had compassion on the multitudes. Somebody go to Matthew 18:33, and somebody else go to Hebrews 5. Somebody go to Matthew
18:33. 18:33 says, shouldest not thou also have had compassion on thy fellow servant, even as I had pity on thee?
Okay. Romans 5 says, he talks about a high priest who can have compassion on the ignorant and them that are out of the way, for that he himself also is compassed with infirmity. Now, somebody else go to Matthew 9, verse 36.
For when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them.
Okay.
Because they fainted and were scared.
Okay. Compassion or pity is the associated emotional awareness of what is left in the neurons from the sensation of pain or suffering. The only way that I can have compassion is if I have suffered. By definition, it's impossible to have compassion if I have never suffered. That's why it was so, I had a really easy life up till just before I was a believer. I mean, I had a lot of crap happen to me, but fundamentally, almost everything whatever I wanted happened. And I couldn't, and it was impossible. I mean, I couldn't even begin to have compassion in anyone.
The wind, it's taking our chance.
So the only way that you can have compassion is to suffer. And the only way Jesus Christ could have compassion and therefore save you or I is if he suffered. And I want you to, I could spend three weeks on this, but I want you to hear this and see if you can make the stretch. That the only purpose of language is so that you can communicate compassion. Everything else is just jacking off. Can everybody get a hold of that a little bit? Now, he who has not suffered, by definition, cannot have compassion or pity. 2 Corinthians, the first chapter, says the following, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted by God. I can't comfort anyone else unless I have suffered and been comforted. Otherwise, I'm just giving you some memorized cliches. I can't speak the word of God unless I've suffered it.
That helps understand the reason for suffering. Unless you're suffering, or if we can't have compassion, there's no compassion, there's nothing.
And when you see it, that's the trick of Satan. Is he tries to get you to a state of being where suffering is valueless. That's a biggie. He tries to get you to a state of being that trivializes suffering. That's what's so evil about these televangelists, is that they trivialize suffering.
They even do greater evil than that, because they say it is not of God, and we'll just take care of that with a little faith.
Right.
And there's no compassion when the Bible talks about pulling them out of the fire and having compassion.
Yeah, there's no compassion unless they get $1,000. And then there's still no compassion. Do you understand? Can we accept this thing? Can we just set aside the suffering? Can you accept for at least the moment? Can you accept the thesis that the purpose of naming the names, the purpose of stringing the names together in sentences, is so that you can communicate suffering? Every other thing that happened as a result of naming the names is only a byproduct. the only works of literature, the only works of art that have lasted, that have stood the test of time, are those that show the suffering and vanity of man. All of the modern things that show the fluff won't last, and haven't lasted throughout history. Anybody want to talk about that anymore? Do you understand it completely?
Well, that's true, because there's been so many times that things that, you know, I've experienced with suffering have ministered to someone else and being able to know what they're feeling or going through and then, you know, speak to that.
Amen. Yeah. I want you to take and imagine the greatest minds in the universe who are trying to prove the Bible. And they're trying to do it. They go up and they run around and try to find Noah's Ark. You know, all these other asinine things that have now been proven to be frauds. What's the only thing that you can prove with the Bible?
Man is fallen.
Man is fallen.
And continues.
Spiritual truth doesn't exist independently, and spiritual truth cannot be observed by the senses. If you can observe it by the senses, it's a guarantee that you've been lied to. Spiritual truth non-exists independently. Doesn't exist. Again, using you, your being as the frame of reference. You cannot see or expect or understand or know spiritual truth independently. It doesn't exist in terms of if you're trying to perceive it by the senses. Every single time that any one of you have gotten in spiritual trouble where you were out of the rest is because something that you could perceive by the senses told you that the spiritual truth didn't exist. And you believed what you could observe by the senses more than you did the spirit. Do you understand that? The only truth is spirit. Everything you observe with your senses, by definition, is a lie. So what discipleship is simply the process of learning to discard the names so that we might see through the senses to be free of physical causation. So that we always are anchored spiritually, the spiritual truth, never by what we see, never by what we hear, never by what we feel, never by what we touch. The Son has made us free, and we're free indeed. We're free in truth. We're free from all physical causation. We're free from names. We're free from sentences. We're free from language. Does that touch any of you?
I can see now the guy or need that when you don't know that to have positive confession.
Right.
To go the other way and think you're speaking it. Yeah, it's without circumstance. It just is. It doesn't need to.
Right. That's why it says, even about Jesus himself, it says he was manifested in the flesh, but he was justified in the spirit. Because what your flesh always tries to do is justify itself, even when it's dying. Now, one can only describe the spiritual condition by parable, by analogy, by pattern, and by metaphor. That's why Jesus said, all things are parables. There's nothing that exists that isn't a parable, that's speaking something else. There's nothing that exists independently that has value of itself. Everything that we can perceive with the senses is valueless if you literalize it. If you make it the thing. Marriage becomes a joke if you literalize it and try to make marriage work. But the moment you give up that and see marriage as the parable of the mystery, then there's fulfillment in it. Can you hear that? Anytime you literalize it, you're taking a stand and being high-minded. Anytime you say, this is the way it's supposed to be, then you've missed the mystery. And every time you say, you should be that way, or I want you to be this way, then you're simply trying to manipulate idolatry with language, and you've totally destroyed the possibility of a spiritual relationship. Especially in marriage, but even in a body, because we are so close that we know each other so intimately. If you say to me, this is the way I want you to, this is what you should do, this is what I want you to be, then you're literalizing me as the parable. That's really dumb. But what you're doing in truth is worshiping the graven image that's on the wall of your temple. Because you're saying, it's supposed to be like this, and it's not supposed to be like that. And you're all doing it. You're doing it because of the graven image that was engraved by the use of names, by the naming. Capisce? Were any of you around when I gave a whole I did a tape that I hurt my own brain, but it was called The Concept of Zero?
Yeah.
Would you make a note, if anybody here hasn't heard that tape, to get a copy of it? The Concept of Zero. And I'm sure you guys haven't heard it. You haven't heard it. You haven't heard it. You haven't heard it. Well, at least five.
Well, you don't need five tapes. You just make one, we'll pass it around. Two.
We'll just take one.
Yeah. I can get mine.
Two. Just make three. Do you understand that the concept of zero is impossible? Concept of zero. It's impossible for there to be zero. Also, it's impossible for there to be a negative. No thing or event is negative. A negative sign or a word or a concept is only a useful means of manipulating within a limited framework. But there's never such thing as a negative. There's never such thing as zero. There's always something. A negative word, sign, or concept is so in its use only. Its reason for existence is always positive. Towards something or some course of action or some activity. And again, what we're talking about, that all words and all things in life are either leading us towards a wedding or towards a funeral. There's never a zero position. There's never a neutral zone. All men, by their thoughts, words, and deeds, are either vessels of wrath or vessels of mercy, being built, edifying the bride, or being destroyed. Now, spiritually, being destroyed is a positive. I wish you'd have heard the concept of zero. Do you understand that nothing doesn't exist? Nothing doesn't exist. Everything is a something. The name nothing exists, but it doesn't exist independently of anything. Nothing, immaterial, non-existent, are not names of anything. They only have verbal meanings, and these negative names are limited in their use to the substitute system of which they are part. I have no money. That's not a good example. What are you doing? Nothing is a ludicrous possibility. It doesn't exist. That person is immaterial. That doesn't exist. What are you doing? Nothing only is a means of describing something within, but we think that nothing is something. And we think that gray or being neutral is a value. We think that there is a place that is independent of either going to a wedding or to a funeral, and it's some kind of a neutral position. And that because I am in this neutral position, I am not accountable. That's what the world thinks. We think that I'm just thinking about this. I'm just checking it out. I'm just hanging around.
Just being lukewarm.
Yeah, I'm just taking it easy. Hear me. It's impossible for you to be taking it easy. You're either going full speed toward the wedding, and the evidence that you're going at the speed of light towards the wedding is that you're at rest. Or you're going full speed toward the funeral. And the evidence that you're going full speed toward the funeral is if there's anxiousness or worry. There's any anxiety. Nothing doesn't exist. But our language has given us the luxury to think that this neutral state exists. Again, in English, we have these great words and all these descriptions. We say that love is the opposite, or hate is the opposite of love. Not in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the opposite of love is sloth, neutral, doing nothing, thinking about it. That's the opposite of love. But our language has permitted us this illusion of neutral. Or nothing. And it's a device that God has put there so that only those with a zeal will see the mystery. Only those who have sold out will see God. The way we use the language is an evidence of our spiritual condition. There's a lot of ancient philosophers, a lot of ones that we've now put in our vocabulary, who have said that to deny the existence of a thing or to resist the thing is to affirm its existence and to give it power. That's the trick that the God of this world has succeeded in doing in each of you. Either by resisting or by denying it. So that's why it's so vital. Do you realize that some of you have lived in the state of denial your entire conscious life? Does anybody have any idea what I'm talking about?
That's almost like agree with your adversary quickly.
While you're in the way. What's the psychological definition of denial?
I didn't hear what you said. What was it?
Some of you have lived in the state or condition of a denial your entire conscious life. That's a good place to stop. I want you to think about that.
By saying nothing or those type of words too, I realize that you're saying you don't need to prophesy. That's basically what you're.
Yeah.
And, you know, I say it all the time. I keep myself saying nothing. We're doing nothing.
Out.
It's a device. Let me give you some examples of denial. People that have been married for a long time, in many, many instances, they literally hate their mate. But they are in a state of denial about it because it is so frightening that they deny that existence, put it in a closet, and they affirm their love with words constantly. But in a state of being in actuality, they are in a state of hatred. That's why Spirit says, to deny your mate the statement that you feel at that moment like you hate them is to hate them. And you walk in that state of denial thinking, I shouldn't think this. And pretty soon you have a closet so full of I shouldn't do this or I should do that, that there is no possibility of spontaneity. An alcoholic denies they're an alcoholic. And in the state of that denial, that's too easy. The biggest denial that we walk in is fear. The idea that there are 1,000 fears that you haven't faced, but you deny the fear, and so you walk as though it doesn't exist, but then you're plagued in 1,000 other ways. It comes up. You don't admit the fear, you haven't faced it. I mean, a grand example. A large percentage of the American public hates their parents, one or both of their parents. Hates them with a perfect hatred. What is the definition of hate?
Despise
like an enemy. It means to kill, doesn't it? Well, just what does it mean in English? What's an English definition of hate? What's the Webster? What is the Webster definition of hate?
To loathe.
Intense dislike. Loathing. Despise. Don't want to be around them.
What should you do if, you know, kids are, they say, I hate you, you know, I mean, should you?
You should address it.
I mean, what do? You explain to them what hate means? Do you really mean this?
Yes.
I mean, because I know some people say, don't use that word, that's not a nice word to use, but then they don't understand why they're not able to use it.
No, you have to use it. You have to teach them.
Is it all right for them to say that or each?
Sure.
They know what it feels like. They're just not speaking the truth.
No, I don't really know that they hate. They don't know that they understand the word.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. That it's important that you sit down with them at that point. I mean, I deal with it every day because the policy that we have with the kids and the, you know.
What policy?
Well, that they can always come and see me about something, and so on.
So they do.
Yeah. But the mystery of it is that they never feel. Hopefully they'll always feel empowered, much to the chagrin of Doug and Joysanna and others. But constantly, I mean, I hate Mr. D.
Yeah.
I hate Joysanna. I hate Keith. I hate Johnny. I hate this. I hate that. What do you want to, should we go kill him? That's what the fruit of hate is, to kill. Well, maybe I don't hate him. You know, I mean, you just have to push it. I do the same thing to the kids that I do to you. I mean, I push it so that you push the definitions to the wall. Like the cause of an instant hot seat in the school is for one of the teachers to say, because I told you so, that's why. But I mean, but that's like the total manipulation, and that's fascism to the nth degree. And I mean, I hate it.
Just do it.
Just do it because I told you to.
Just do it.
Anyway, let's have some cake and ice cream, quick.
Yeah.
Take a big guy.